November 16th at the Chesterfield Gallery in Lower Manhattan.
Online bidding begins Thursday, November 2nd. Go to WBAI.org and click on the art auction pop-up.
Both well-known and soon-to-be-well-known artists have donated a wide range of artworks for every taste and budget.
This is an opportunity to acquire artwork by such luminaries as Tom Otterness,
whose little bronze men adorn the subway at 14th Street,
Richard Avedon, Allen Ginsberg.
Did you know he was a photographer too?
Barbara Mensch and Richard Haas.
So go online to WBAI.org and mark your calendars for the live auction exhibit reception on November 16th.
We did it before and we can do it again.
The owners of the Empire State Building where WBAI's transmitter is located have pushed WBAI into a crisis. The crisis is real, and we need your help to turn this crisis around. We need your time, energy, and especially your skills. We need you to volunteer to help build our off-air fundraising campaign. We need grant writers, event planners, social media and computer technology experts, phone banking volunteers, and particularly those experienced with obtaining large donor contributions. Are you an experienced fundraiser? We need you now. Historically, WBAI listeners have shown great heart and courage in the face of political adversity. We must do this again to save our station. Please call 347-647-WBAI or 347-335-0008 or email us at wbai.pacifica@gmail.com and let us know how you could help. Again, please call us at 347-647-WBAI or 347-335-0008 or email us at wbai.pacifica@gmail.com. Together, we will win.
We did it before and we...
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country. A media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us, writer, editor, pundit, and curator, Matthew Kressel. We're going to be talking about a movie. You better stay tuned. Oh, yes. It's all spoilers. I didn't mean that to anybody. Hello, we're on the air. I've been talking to people on Facebook Live, you see, where there is at the moment, a relatively small audience. Is this? Yeah, the mic is barely on. I'm tapping it. Do me a favor, Matt. Tap your... Oh, first
tap,
of all...
Tap, tap, tap.
Try that again.
Tap, 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 tap.
Okay.
There we go.
Bring that mic a lot closer.
A lot closer. All right.
Yeah, aim it sort of like... Yes.
Like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How's that?
Among other things, say how's that again.
How's that again?
Thank you. Yeah. The headphones...
Headphones are helpful.
Mine weren't turned on. You don't really need yours unless we take phone calls.
All right.
Okay, we have to get announcements out of the way. We will tell people first that this is a show about the Blade Runners.
The Blade Runners, the brothers.
Yes, there are several. Yeah. Yes, there are several involved. There are several just in one movie. But they are all... No, Paul isn't present. He gets killed in the beginning of the first, or at least hospitalized. Paul, isn't it?
You're talking about David Bautista?
No. I mean, in the first the first Blade Runner who's giving the test and gets blown away by Brian James.
Yeah, Holden was shot right at the very beginning.
Yes, Holden.
Holden.
Oh, yeah. Here's a trivia. Before I have a great trivia question.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. In... one scene in the original Blade Runner.
Yeah.
You have Roy Batty.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the name of the replicant who shoots Holden right in the beginning? The actor's Brian James.
Leon.
Leon, absolutely.
Okay.
So, what similarity do they have in another science fiction world by an auteur? I figured this is it hit me
when
the
you
last
say
time.
What relation can you give me another hint?
Yeah, another director of major science fiction movies have used both actors.
Well, Outland, right? Wasn't the no?
No, good movie though.
I'm not sure.
The answer is that Brian James is Bruce Willis's boss and the head of the police in The Fifth Element.
Oh, right.
And in Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, Rutger Hauer is the president of Earth, both movies directed by Luc Besson.
Okay. Well, that's sort of like a couple degrees of separation there, though.
Well, it's one director's degree of separation only.
All right.
And both directors are certainly auteurs with French accents.
I give you credit for linking the two. I wouldn't have connected them quite like that, but...
I don't know why it came to me while I was watching. But anyhow, folks, we are going to be discussing Blade Runners, Blade Runner, the original, because you have to go to that source. We're not going to be discussing Philip K. Dick for the most part, because that's really a totally different universe. I was going to tell you, we were in a pub before, the thing that really blows me away in the book that never happens in the movie at all and couldn't happen in the movies, that Rachel...
Yeah.
Is made out of the exact same model and looks identical to Pris.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Rachel thinks that he can't retire Pris because they look the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The idea that there's a limited number of models, that's something I was actually wondering watching Blade Runner 2049. And, you know, like, well... how many different implants could there be? But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
We are.
What we need to tell listeners is that, yeah, the talk is going to be that kind of deep-level geek talk about Blade Runner. And I can't think of anybody better to discuss this than Matthew Kressel. Because Is it fair to say that the original Blade Runner is one of your favorite movies of all time?
No, that would be incorrect. I would say that it is my favorite movie of all time.
Okay.
I was
thinking of saying that, but...
It is. I've seen the original film in the various versions. As we were saying before, I've lost count.
Yeah.
Over 100 times, I would guess.
Wow!
I used to be able to...
I'm only about 7 or 8.
I used to be able to... Well, I probably still could recite the film from start to finish from memory. I used to do this party trick on New Year's Eve that we would put on one of the versions of Blade Runner. My friends would pick a random scene, mute the TV, put on the closed captions.
And you would MST3K it.
I would turn my back to the screen and I would just get like a cue so I knew where we were. And then I would recite the lines. And usually within like, you know, I would get about 98% of the lines. This is not something that I'm necessarily proud of.
Right. This is as I tell people when I say I've worked here for more than 50 years, I say this is not a boast. Yeah. This is a call for help.
It was kind of an obsession of mine for years to just watch the movie as often as possible.
One of our listeners says, good science fiction is hard to do, and I'm going to have to pick up the phone, and financial risk great. So I appreciate when science fiction movies are made. Blade Runner was fascinating, typo, just checking out the background. It's like what the world would look like if we were all crowded into a Hong Kong-type living space. I would say that was true of the first film.
The first one
is
more Hong Kong. The second one, I got elements of, like, you know, northern Russia and, like, parts
Siberia.
Of... Siberia. Like, you know, parts of... Honestly, like, when Kay was flying over the city, it reminded me of Queens. Like, just how densely packed... Or, you know, Queens and Brooklyn, how densely packed the buildings are together, and you just see this little space between them, especially if you've ever taken the M line... which is just above the height of the building.
Well, I lived on the 7 train.
Oh, the 7 train, you know, any of the elevated trains.
Because until 25 years ago, I lived all my life in Jackson Heights.
Yeah.
So I'm a Queens kid. Or as I tell people, well, I grew up in Queens, but now I'm in Brooklyn. Yeah. But Queens is a stomping ground for me. I've also lived in Forest Hills and various haunts.
Mm-hmm.
Of Queens, but Queens is very much, I'll say this about Queens, it has a better concentration of restaurants.
Depends on where you are in Queens.
Well, there's some better restaurants in Brooklyn, but, you know, it's like if you go to a particular neighborhood, like where I grew up in Jackson Heights,
right,
in Elmhurst, you can't go 5 blocks without a really great restaurant being nearby, and you can just name a cuisine. And a story is true also.
Yeah, I mean, in my neighborhood, it's a little bit harder to do that.
You get good Indian food where you are.
There,
don't say where you are, but
there are two Indian places nearby. One of them is quite good, and one of them is so-so.
Right. Well, that's always the case.
Yeah.
But the best Thai restaurant I know is in Elmhurst.
Hmm.
In all the city, and we can talk about this off the air.
Yeah.
And Filipino, and Argentinian, and Peruvian. Although that's a chain.
Yeah.
Pio Pio.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pio Pio is a chain. Anyway, here's the point, peoples. We are really going to be discussing Blade Runner. I mean, this is spoiler filled. If you have not seen the latest version of Blade Runner, Blade Runner 2049, go see it. It's brilliant. B, and I say that now because all the big new movies, the Marvel movies and everything, are opening pretty soon. I think Ragnarok is opening on Friday, you know, 2 days from now, unless I'm mistaken. And it's going to be pushing Blade Runner out, which is for no logical reason to me, has not been doing good box office.
Well, I have some theories on that.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
But for whatever reason, mm-hmm. it's not selling big tickets the way a new Marvel movie will.
Yeah.
And even though theaters are digital, there will be far fewer screenings of Blade Runner within a couple of days. I'm very pleased that a couple of theaters are still doing it.
Yeah.
And people should definitely check that out, because this is a movie that wants the big screen.
Absolutely.
It really does. I mean, Roger Deakins, the one who they call the bridesmaid, mm-hmm. because he's gotten, what, like 16 nominations as best cinematographer and has never, ever won.
Yeah, if he doesn't win for this, there's no justice in the world.
Well, there's no justice for
what happened already.
True Grit, all his Coen Brothers films. This is
perhaps...
I hate
the most spectacular visual film I've ever seen.
I don't want to invoke the A word, but it is awesome.
It is awesome.
It makes you feel awe.
Awe. And
A-W-E.
And also, like, in some ways, terrified of this potential future, which I think is its purpose.
Absolutely.
Just the we were talking a little bit about the world
of
Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
It is a horrible world. Blade Runner 2019, the first film.
That's what I've been calling it as well.
It was a dystopia, okay? But it's a sexy dystopia.
Yeah, I mean, we're living in a dystopia right now, but it's a different one.
I don't think it's quite sexy right now. But if you look at Blade Runner 2019, the cityscapes look very similar to today's cityscapes. The streets remind us in certain ways of our streets today. There's a kind of like, boy, isn't that cool, even in its grittiness in the first one. In the second film, I feel that there is no part of that world I want to live in. I don't want to live in Kay's apartment. I don't want to live
on that box.
I don't want to live... I don't want to be in the police station. I don't want to be on the streets. I don't want to be in the dumps of San Diego. Even in the Wallace Corporation building, that was.
Yeah, that's not like the Tyrell Corporation.
No, and
which had all this lovely.
And
the Wallace Corporation is really, and you never want to get near Jared Leto in any movie.
You know, like the original.
Jared Leto is in.
No, the original. Has been copied a gazillion times, right? Just the visual. And it's been copied so much, it's almost become like the default vision when we think of the future is like the Blade Runner future, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's changing somewhat.
I think it started with Metropolis, and I think that the people who made Blade Runner intentionally used a couple of...
Metropolis, and then also the Inkle from Mobius was heavily influenced,
yes.
and the Edward Hopper painting Night
but
Hawks
I always
and,
yeah absolutely
well that
but
was,
I mostly think of that one building, which by the way is in the new film as well,
the Tyrell Corporation,
the
ziggurat or the
yeah.
pyramid
yeah. Yes
yeah it's in the original, but if you notice, I mean sorry the 24/9, but if you notice the lights are off,
yes.
Which I thought was brilliant.
This is a film that you can't just see it once.
No.
This is a film that deserves cult status. It is a future cult film.
I think it will.
There's no question about it.
Yeah. It's going to be a film that's going to be talked about for a while. I think that it also has... It's a film that you can't watch without feeling something intensely, okay? And you go into certain films, like a lot of the Marvel films do this, and you kind of know what to expect in a Marvel film. There's going to be some big baddie, and the hero
is going to be tested somehow, and eventually he will overcome the big baddie and maybe sacrifice something along the way. It's a standard, like, you know, hero trope, right? We see it in so many movies. And you know what? Audiences have come to expect that in a film without even realizing it. So if when films don't conform to that trope, that storytelling mode, we are made uncomfortable. And I
which is funny, because it's like we're being made uncomfortable because we're not conforming to a certain dystopia.
In other words, the film is like, we've been trained in some ways that film validates our expectations, right? Mm-hmm. So we have an expectation and it validates it. I think that what Blade Runner does is it pauses so long with each scene, not in a boring way, but in a way that makes you really, really feel every scene. And it pauses it in such a way that makes you feel something. And it doesn't proceed. I mean, if you back up and look at the plot, you'd be like, oh, well, yeah, it was sort of like he goes from A to B to C to D. It was a detective story, right? I don't think that's a spoiler. But the way in which it moves is not Hollywood at all.
No. It reminds me of two specific directors.
Okay.
Kubrick.
Yeah, and Kubrick. You know, it's funny that you say that, because I've been talking about this movie for so long, since it came out, I mean, like for, what has it been,
30-something years. Oh, this, yes.
Well, the new one.
The new one. The first one doesn't remind me much of Kubrick, but this one does.
No, this one does. So like...
The Villeneuve movie.
I was talking about... The first one's obviously film noir, right? It was film noir, but they call it future noir, right? So it's that like, you know, jaded detective.
But that's more the Alan Ladd cut, the theatrical cut.
But even without the voiceover,
even without that, yes, there is still definitely some of that there.
This film, you're right, and you're the first person who said that to me, and absolutely, it's Kubrick-esque.
Kubrick.
Right?
I've used Kubrickian, but I'll
Kubrickian,
take Kubrick-esque.
And it's those whatever long, rolls off the slow shots that allow you to absorb the scene, but they like build to this emotional crescendo. Right?
They're almost existentially done. There.
Yeah. And the music, I mean, you know,
it's a fine, fine soundtrack.
It's haunting. It's so like with the original of 2019, I love that Vangelis soundtrack. I can put it on as background music.
And that's echoed in the new soundtrack.
It's echoed. But the new one is not a soundtrack that I would necessarily want to listen to be entertained. It is a haunting soundtrack. It is like atmospheric in a way that is just...
It's one you might want to... Close your eyes, put on your Penfield mood organ if you're a fan of the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, put on maybe a color organ at the same time.
Yeah.
And listen to it that way, because that's what it does. But what it is made for and what it is perfect for is this film. But you know what? We're ahead of ourselves.
We
have announcements to make. Okay. And we have the official Hour of the Wolf review of the movie that Dan Persons did. So announcements first.
Right.
Okay. This week, he finally, thank you, Bill Shun, got out the publicity. I always see the publicity for his reading series like the day after I've done a show, and it's like, oh, for God's sakes, I could have promoted this on the air. There are two well-known science fiction reading series in New York. One of them is the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series, which Matt is the co-host,
co-curator
of. Yeah, I use the word curator.
We say co-host. Yeah.
But co-host is fine. Co-host, co-producer with Ellen Datlow, who, by the way, will be on the air next week, along with Rob Kilheffer and Pam Weintraub.
Oh.
Now, if you people Google those three names and see what that adds up to. It'll give you sort of a, well, what do they call it in the Google search thing, Google Chrome? It's the Omni bar. Yes, that Omni bar.
Yeah.
The people who have revived and brought back Omni magazine will be our guests next week.
I have it in my backpack.
I haven't seen a freaking issue.
I can
yet.
Show the yes, Facebook
yes,
Live
can,
folks.
Yes, you can so put
if you're,
it on Facebook
if you're,
Live.
If you're on Facebook, I'll show you.
Yeah, absolutely. So while Matt is doing that, there's another series. It's not, strictly speaking, a science fiction series. Ooh, that nice cover. It looks like the old Omni magazine. Yeah, hold it up a little and a little over 2 years. Yes, better. Excellent. There we go. It's about time. Yes, that's right. Ellen told me the first issue. Yeah,
inside and out.
It is handsome.
Yeah.
From the people who bring you magazines from the top floors of buildings.
Yes.
Let's not go there. Mm. Well, it's still a Guccione pub or whatever they call. What do they call it now that he's gone?
I know the parent company's Penthouse, but I don't know. The...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. But there was a parent company over
parent company of parent
Penthouse.
Company.
So it was Guccione Enterprises or
okay.
something.
I don't know.
But it's still Penthouse.
Yeah.
At any rate, there's another reading series that run by Bill Shun, that a fine SF writer himself, a Nebula nominated finalist, on a couple of occasions. I think possibly Hugo nominated.
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
And he runs a reading series called Line Break. And this is in Queens at a really cool little venue, that means get there early, called QED, where they do all kinds of things. In fact, when their show is over, you need to get out quickly because there's going to be a different show after. They do like three or four different things, including like weaving classes and teaching how to podcast classes. They do all kinds of stuff there. But what Bill does is he brings in an eclectic bunch mm-hmm. of people that mostly read or tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this coming week, when I looked at the picture, I should have realized Austin Grossman. And when I see the picture, 1 second. There we go, Facebook people. There.
Well, Facebook people can just...
There you go. You
search
Google
for Line Break and it yes. will come up. Line Break series.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. But you should know that Austin Grossman is the twin brother of... twice appeared in Hour of the Wolf, Lev Grossman, author mm-hmm. of The Magicians and other works. But The Magicians... I'm waiting for the third season. I like that show.
It's a good show.
It really is.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. So, Austin Grossman, Kemjoy, UKWU. Ukwu?
I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
Ukwu. I'm going to guess okay. Ukwu. And she's a collection from Brain Mill Press. Sam J. Miller. An old friend of both of ours
mm-hmm.
and a frequent reader for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings and the KGB Fantastic mm-hmm. Fiction Readings. Legendary poet David Mills. Oh, I've seen him once. Actually, it's something else Bill produced. It wasn't a QED. So, Peter Bryce, an editorialist who's an attorney and essayist. You see, it's not all fiction. Bill Shun always does a little bit in there. Oh, and Matt Kressel.
I will be there as well.
Matt Kressel will be there. A multiple Nebula Award finalist. You see, he says it. We were talking about this off the air. And World Fantasy Award finalist. His first novel, King of Shards, was hailed as majestic, resonant, reality-twisting madness by NPR Books. He co-hosts, well, we said it. Already.
Yeah.
Also, you've got some stories coming out, don't you?
Yeah. I've got a story coming out in Nightmare in December.
Disclaimer, I do the audio editing in a job that I took over from mutual friend Raj Khanna.
Raj Khanna, yeah.
Although I've been doing it 3.5 years now.
Yeah.
And I think he only did it for about a year.
Yeah. So the story is called Will You Meet Me There Out Beyond the Bend?
Yeah.
It's a horror story.
And it will be podcast.
It will be podcast. I believe Stefan Rudnicki is going to narrate that.
I believe so.
And then there's a really cool anthology coming out by Ellen Datlow called Mad Hatters and March Hares.
We're not going to hear the end of that. Also, she'll be coming on the show. She claims with six of the writers.
Then that might... Really?
On Hour of the Wolf.
So I might be one of them.
You might. You yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes. So news flash.
Yeah, I didn't even know
you're
I'm coming.
To be this show
so
again
I guess I'm
within
going
a month.
To be on again. So that's coming
and
out.
There's
going to
be
December.
A party for that, both in Connecticut and at KGB.
Yes, there is a reading at the Alice Tea Shop in Mystic, Connecticut. I believe it's December 13th. I have to check on that, but. My story is called In Memory of a Summer's Day. And, it's sort of about... I went to the Alice in Wonderland exhibit at the... they had in Manhattan a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
I went there, yeah.
And what struck me about it was kind of how creepy Carol was. Like, what do you call it?
Well, he wasn't. You see, that's controversial today.
It's controversial.
I don't know.
Like
get the Harvey Weinstein
he's
Award today for pedophilia
of 13-year-old girls in their underwear.
Here's the thing: is that was not an uncommon Victorian practice. He was one of many, many people who did that.
All right. Well,
there's
be
context.
That as it may,
yes.
I found this quite disturbing, and I took the point of view of the real Alice Liddell, and how this may have traumatized her and how she might have as an adult decided that she wanted to get revenge, so to speak.
I've heard that, and I've heard also that's apocryphal.
It could be.
Carol really wasn't a pedophile, and somebody on Facebook is like screaming, "He wasn't a pedophile."
Oh well, it's a story, it's fiction, so you could take it or not. Anyway,
it is fiction.
I don't really mention.
Tom Dish did a wonderful rendition called Black Alice.
Yeah,
A lot of people have dwelt on some of these things. Suffice it to say that the Reverend Charles Dodgson was a complicated, fascinating man with many facets.
I mean,
dark and light.
If you didn't know what I just said going into the story, there's literally nothing in the story that says that. That says that overtly. It's just if you know that, it may give more meaning to.
It wasn't
what
a secret. He displayed the photographs. People saw them.
Right.
I don't know if there was a gallery showing, but anybody who came to visit the Reverend could see these. This was not like a secret kind of thing that he hid away.
Anyway, it's a story. And then I just had a French translation of The Last Novelist come out in a magazine called Bifrost.
Far out.
Yeah, and then I have a...
Is that B.I. Frost?
B.I. Frost, yeah. And really great-looking magazine. And I have a Polish translation of The Sounds of Old Earth, which is a Nebula finalist, coming out in a magazine called Smokopolitan. I don't know how to pronounce it. Smokopolitan?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Call Rick Bowes, he would know.
Yeah. And then a couple others, but yeah.
Read Caroline Leach's In the Shadow of the Dream Child for a devastating deconstruction of the myth, says one of our listeners.
Okay, I will. I will check it out. I'm going to
by the way,
read the comments
people
after
at
this
home, if you want, you can log into Facebook with your computer or your phone or whatever.
If you're listening live, obviously.
or even if you
or
are.
Or even if you have a time machine. You can,
yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, this will stay up. This will be publicly available
for
a couple of years.
On, well,
yes, they can comment after the fact and do
on the Facebook
on Facebook
Live. So even if it's
on
not
my
live
page.
Anymore, they can still comment.
It'll be on my page, Jim Freund. I make it public,
all right.
So you don't have to be friended to me. yeah. in order to access it or comment.
Yeah.
Anybody can comment there. And what was very interesting is 2 weeks ago after the show,
yeah.
We got maybe 30 comments during the show
mm-hmm.
and maybe something like 25 views.
Yeah.
Then there were 500 views and over 100 comments about a week later.
Okay.
So it goes on,
yeah.
which is one of the things I really find cool about that medium, about
yeah.
about that platform is the better word.
Interaction is always a quick good thing.
It really is.
Yeah.
Then the next reading series we should discuss.
The next reading series, yeah. So like Jim said, I co-host the Fantastic Fiction at KGB series with Ellen Datlow. It's at the KGB bar in Manhattan, a really, really cool bar. It's
Wear Red.
It's Soviet.
When you go wear
it's Soviet themed bar.
Well, you know that was genuine.
No, I know it was a real speakeasy for Ukrainian socialists.
Yeah, not a speakeasy, but a hang. Well, it wasn't prohibition.
No, I don't mean in terms of alcohol. I mean in terms of that they would go and speak their socialist views in the back of the.
A secret. Well, not a secret. It was a place where they held meetings
yeah.
with a big picture of Lenin.
It's still there. It's kind of kitschy and but it's a cool place to have readings.
It's
and,
cool kitschy.
And the audience is really friendly. Like so, if you're a fan of science fiction, fantasy, and horror, and you're looking to meet people or just listen to. Good fiction and you know hear what's out there. Check it out. It's the next reading is November 15th, which is we're always the third Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m. And this month we have Grady Hendrix and David Leo Rice. Now, if you haven't heard of Grady Hendrix, you should check him out. Paperbacks from Hell is actually nonfiction, and we almost never do. I don't think we've ever done nonfiction.
Yes, you had a guy named Jim Baker.
Okay, but
and
that was before
was,
my
he was
tenure.
Brilliant.
So let me just say briefly.
I remember that one.
Paperbacks from Hell. So basically, Grady Hendrix read like 400 and some odd paperbacks from the 80s, horror paperbacks, and wrote a summary of this
oh
from the
God.
80s and like maybe it's a few early 90s, and wrote a summary of them and all the themes and topics and how like some of them were. Terrible and some of them were brilliant and the covers were amazing and the plots and he's and Grady is very obsessive, like he mapped out, like at one point he was like where all the various animal attacks happened across, you know, the UK, and he charted this, and I mean it's just the amount of detail. And on top of this, Grady is just an amazing performer, basically.
Yeah.
And so if you just get it, if you have a chance, if you're in Manhattan on November 15th, 7 p.m. KGB bar, 85 East 4th Street, check
yeah,
it out.
I have a show that night or I would be there.
Yeah.
I used to be at every single KGB. I used to record them
yeah.
right from the beginning.
Yeah. Oh, and we have a podcast. So if you can't make it, go to kgbfantasticfiction.org on the net. Did I say that right? Not org? Org?
Yes, org.
Org. And,
it's like arg, but it's with an O. Org.
You just go to our podcast category. Or actually, we're on iTunes, too. If you have iTunes, you can listen to going back. The advantage
of going to iTunes is that if you use the right podcast software,
yeah.
you can just subscribe to it, and whenever there's a new episode,
yeah.
it will download.
You can do that.
I like Pod
with our
Kicker
feed,
for that.
Yeah, with as well.
But, yeah, and by the way, there's an RSS feed for Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah,
for this very radio show.
Yeah,
I have no idea how the bleep to access it, but can be done.
Yeah, and David Leo Rice is also reading, and he wrote A Room in Dodge City. I'm not as familiar with his work, but it sounds really cool.
Like the title.
Yeah. It's the start of a trilogy, his first novel. So, yeah, come and check that out.
Okay. Now, a week before that is the other reading series in New York. I guess the older sister of the KGB Fantastic Fiction. Well, yes, and that's a good thing.
It is.
And you know what? We make sure. We don't steal audience from each other.
No,
we were very careful going for before when Ellen was involved, and all that. That when Gordon Van Gelder began the New York Review of Science Fiction readings and all that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that was like 12 years or so before KGB, but we time it out so that generally, the NURSIF, New York Review of Science Fiction readings, the NURSIF readings are the first generally the first Tuesday of every month.
Yeah.
That doesn't always happen.
Right.
Now, next Tuesday, which is when it will be, is Election Day. But it's a who gives a about that election outside of actually some of the...
Well, the Constitutional Convention.
Exactly, the Con-Con.
Yeah.
That's an important issue.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a very important issue. It's a very confusing issue, too.
Yeah.
So it's a con confusing. Mm-hmm. And the so you should vote in the afternoon and then come over. Now, if it were a presidential, see, I would then either move to a Monday, a Wednesday, or possibly the next week. It once happened, and only once ever, that I had to move it to what turned out to be the second Tuesday of the month, but then the third Wednesday of the month was the day after. Mm. Because month started on Wednesday, as it does this month, as a matter of fact. So if I had had to push it to the 14th, then there would be the 14th and the 15th. Not good, because we don't want... Then we would be bumping into each other. But we have two readers, one of whom is a member of Matt's writers group, who has been, as a group, in the past, a frequent friend on our air, and that is the Altered Fluid Writers Group. Mm-hmm. And that is Chris Steichman.
Yeah.
And Chris, who designed the logo for Hour of the Wolf. And
That's right.
That's right. And a gorgeous logo it is. I love it. I love the work she does. And has done book covers for our first and foremost guest on this program, who is Richard Bowes.
Mm-hmm.
And just she writes wonderfully. So I know you people get to give her criticisms. I get to say she writes wonderfully.
I will also say she writes wonderfully.
So there. So yeah. There you have right here two endorsements. And one person says, one person says to you, I just subscribed to the KGB podcast. Thanks, Matthew.
You're very welcome. Hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, that's a fellow named Jim, whose icon you will recognize. It's Peter Capaldi is what he's currently using.
Oh, nice.
But he changes it every so often, okay. Probably changing about 2 months to a different gender. But anyway, don't say anything, sir. Don't say anything. Anyway. Chris Steichman lives in New York City. She is a founding member of the Alter Fluid Writers Group. Her work has appeared in Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. I said it right for the first time in my life. Year's Best Fantasy 9, Strange Horizons, Sybil's Garage, edited by Matthew Kressel. The Best of All Flesh and Sympathy for the Devil. She has stories upcoming in, guess what, Ellen Datlow's Alice in Wonderland anthology, Mad Hatters and March Hares, and Analog Magazine in January.
Oh, it is a great story.
Yeah. Read more of her work at What's Wrong with Muriel Puce, PUCE.com. I looked that up, and it's cool. People should do that.
I don't even know about this website.
This is the bio she gave me. I haven't changed a word.
That must be a new site because I remember...
Parts of it, by the way, Chris, if you're listening now or retro, there are a couple of links that don't work.
Well, it's an amazing URL.
Yes, isn't it?
Wait,
though?
What is it again? What's wrong with
Muriel Puce?
That's awesome.
.com. It is.
I love that.
It is. And when you find out who Muriel Puce is, it gets even cooler. Mm. But I'm going to leave that to the curious listener to find out.
Yeah.
Our other reader will be S.A. Chakraborty. She's returning. She was here January of 2016, along with Harris Durrani and Cam Roberson or Rob Cameron, one of those one people, was the curator that night. Oh, God, he had somebody else, too. It was a great evening. I think maybe Rob was the other reader. But S.A. Chakraborty is a fantasy writer from New York. Her debut, The City of Brass, which is starting to get a lot of brass, it's coming out November 14th, as a matter of fact. That's the big launch party for it. It's an epic fantasy set in the 18th century Middle East that will be published in, well, November 14th, 2017, by Harper Voyager. When not buried in books about Mughal, I am going to pronounce it Mughal, M-U-G-H-A-L. I am pretty sure that's Mughal, like somebody who runs a big movie studio is a Mughal.
M-U-G-H-A-L?
Yeah. Okay. I'm pretty sure. Mughal Portraiture and Omani History, S.A., come on, her name is Shannon, S.A. enjoys hiking, knitting, and cooking unnecessarily complicated meals for her family. You can find her online at S.A. Chakraborty, that's S-A-C-H-A-K-R-A-B-O-R-T-Y, Chakraborty. It's actually not that difficult to name at all. .com or on Twitter at S-C-H-A-K-R-A-B-S, where she likes to ramble about history, politics, and Islamic art. And she's a proud member of the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers Group, speaking of Rob.
Yeah.
So this book is getting a huge push from Harper.
Yeah,
and,
you're saying.
Yeah, and she is a future star. You know, she's up there, and she's a delightful person and a very, very good writer. So even though the book isn't out, her star is ascending.
Yes.
If I knew the name of the Islamic stars, I would use that. Never mind that she's born Irish. She's married
to
Islam.
Was it Afsasat was the star that...
Oh, that sounds right.
Was the star that Einstein used, or they used to prove general relativity? Does that sound right? No, actually, I know they used Mercury.
No,
I mean the planet, but I mean...
What, wasn't it to prove actually gravity or something like that and the bending of light?
Yeah, that the...
Transit of
I know
Venus.
The transit of Venus or Mercury was like slightly off based on Einstein's general relativity, but
no,
I
it
remember
was done by David Tennant and Andy Serkis did it.
Yeah,
there is a movie. There is a TV movie from the BBC with David Tennant and Andy Serkis.
But yeah, I think Afsasat was
Caesar.
One of those one of the stars that they. Used also,
yeah.
If memory serves.
Yes, because the question was whether the light from that star, which is behind the sun, would show at a specific moment.
Right.
Thereby proving that because it was behind the star, light bends.
Yes.
And that showed things about relativity and gravity and stuff like that there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why don't we listen, since we're 48 minutes into the show,
yeah.
Why don't we listen to Dan Person's review of Blade Runner 2049, which is a major reason why we have convened this morning. And everybody enjoy. We'll be back shortly.
I'm Dan Person's movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There is a sequence in Blade Runner 2049 that is... And I'm not being at all ironic about this. Probably the greatest thing I'm going to see all year. It comes after close to 2 hours of watching Ryan Gosling, who plays a replicant, in other words, an artificially engineered human, Blade Runner, in other words, a bounty hunter for other renegade replicants. Do I need to explain these things to this audience? We're watching this replicant Blade Runner named Kay, trying to track down a baby that was born to 2 missing replicants, which is a thing that isn't supposed to happen, but apparently has. The trail leads to a former Blade Runner, Rick Deckard, played in this film as he was in the original Blade Runner by Harrison Ford, who may also be a replicant himself, depending on which cut of Blade Runner you've seen, although this sequel lands pretty firmly on Replicant, and who is hiding out in an abandoned casino in a nuclear zone that we presently call Las Vegas. Deckard is a little cautious about Kay's presence, which is the least one can say about someone who pulls a gun on you, and the upshot is that Kay and Deckard maneuver each other into a fistfight in a malfunctioning holographic showroom where projected versions of Elvis, Marilyn, and a bevy of showgirls sputter randomly to life on various platforms in the darkened room while a deafening soundtrack cuts in and out at the most disconcerting moments. It is, unambiguously, a fantastic bit of filmmaking using action, editing, lighting, audio, and special effects to create something surreal, disturbing, exciting, and weirdly funny. It is also, as I noted, something that comes after close to 2 hours of sitting through a film that alternates between similar stunning moments. It is inarguable that director Denis Villeneuve brings a lot of visual flair to SF, as he demonstrated with his previous film Arrival. Dubious plot points, Hampton Fancher, writer of the first film, has seen fit here to retcon in the replicants, or at least one replicant's ability to procreate, and provide a new, and for me, unacceptable reason why Deckard met the replicant Rachel in the first film, and bits of business that pad out a film that, at 2 hours and 44 minutes with credits, doesn't really need padding. I don't know why we need to spend 15 seconds watching a guy flip through an old book, but we do. Doesn't seem like a lot of time when you say it, but you do feel it, and that kind of stuff adds up after a while. The plus side of keeping your film to 90 minutes, hell, even 70 minutes, is that it forces consistency on you. A good film will likely stay good. A sucky film tends to be reliably sucky throughout. There are moments of supreme beauty and subtle emotion seeded through Blade Runner 2049, an encounter between Kay and a programmer of replicant memories, played with touching fragility by Carla Jury, stands out for me. But there's just too much, too many ravishing establishing shots, too many moments that don't really add to an emotional whole. And for all its action, the finale feels weirdly inert and isn't helped by Ford's blank canvas performance at the end. It was joked that Star Trek The Motion Picture should have been called Star Trek The Motionless Picture because of its emphasis on ambience at the expense of forward momentum. That accusation has also been leveled at the anime sequel Ghost in the Shell Memory for similar reasons. Blade Runner 2049 may well join those films in this dubious fraternity. I noticed that reactions of my Facebook friends have run the gamut between orgasmic to you gotta be kidding me. I fall more into the latter camp, but have to admit there was enough amazing stuff within Blade Runner 2049 that I didn't completely regret sinking nearly 3 hours into the experience, and over time I may learn to, at least, better appreciate the film in the same way that I've come to eventually treasure STTMP. Not so much that it's a great film, but that it dared to rise to something great. Your mileage may vary, and this is a case where it's likely you're not going to know until you delve into it yourself. For your sake, I hope you find Blade Runner 2049 a more elevating experience. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Well, Dan and I don't always agree, and Matthew and I don't, in fact, agree on the very first film, but I the first cut of Blade Runner 2049 was considered 4 hours. 4 freaking hours. And they were thinking of maybe let's put that into two different, part one and part two. And I gotta tell you, if it were 4 hours, I would be fine. I would suggest to people, you want to see a long movie? Go see a Russian movie. Go see the movie by Andrei Tarkovsky called Stalker. if you want to see a long movie, and it supports it. Go see the movie Solaris. Oh, Tarkovsky again. Even the Steven Soderbergh Solaris is like 2.5 hours long. I call movies that run that length immersive. That's the word that I use. And this Villeneuve's films, okay? Now, I haven't seen Sicario or his other films. Yeah, so I've heard, and I will watch it. But for me, it all began with Arrival. And Arrival is... put on your headphones, by the way. Arrival is just one of the... You know, it's in my top X, you know, SF films. It is genius. Arrival takes an unadaptable story by Ted Chiang, which is so dense with material, and somehow being totally faithful to the story, he nonetheless pulls it off in such a manner. The second time you see Arrival is better than the first, because now that you know...
See, we won't say it.
Well, let's just say that it's a cycle. That's fair to say, like the Ring cycle by Wagner is a cycle, and Arrival is a cycle. Dahlgren by Delaney is a cycle. And Arrival has certain cyclic things that occur so that when you see it the second time and you are aware of certain things that go on in the film, they have more impact the second time you see it. I saw
it shows a director that's paying attention to detail in ways that are almost subliminal, that kind of get under your skin.
Yeah.
And you're not realizing it the first time through, and the second time through. I mean, I'm not just talking about the plot structure. I'm talking about just subtle things that they did, you know, with Arrival. By the way, this music, is it? Can they hear it too?
Yes. That's why I had you put in your headphones. That's on the air.
This is the Seawall track?
These are the closing credits.
The closing credits. So I think it's like reprising the...
oh, yeah.
The Seawall scene. I thought that was some of the most beautiful music in the film.
I'll play the Seawall next.
Yeah. It. So, can we talk about...
Oh, yes. Now we have to give the warning again.
Yeah.
Folks, if you have not seen Blade Runner 2049, tune out. Unless you have no intention
it
of
already?
Never seeing it. We are going to be spoiling this movie. We're not going to spoil Arrival, but we are going to be this film, because it's not possible to discuss this in depth without getting into touchy moments. I think Dan's review unavoidably, and many reviews have mentioned that, you know, we're looking for a child, and can replicants replicate, and stuff like that, is one of the major points of this movie. I think that the point of the original Blade Runner is very different than the point of this movie. Yeah. I think that the point of Blade Runner is... And Blade Runner is a movie in which Matt and I had a basic disagreement where I overreacted and just thought, this is not a good film. Partly because I'm such a Philip K. Dick fan.
That's what I was going to say. You're so in love with the book.
Yeah.
When you really love a book and then a film changes it.
Yeah. Although, just having reread the book, redone everything. I saw the movie Friday. Since that time, I've reread the book. I've rewatched the original, the final cut of the original Ridley Scott film.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm well versed. Although I would have loved to have seen 2049 again tonight, if possible.
How many times have you seen 2049? Just once. Just the once. Okay.
And that's not enough.
I've seen it twice, and I feel like I need to see it a few more times because I saw it with it twice within the first week that it came out, and not seen it since. And I feel like
it holds up to
some of the aspects are fading from my mind,
because the very things Dan were talking about, they're not boring; they're immersive. You have to take a look.
I was
at
never
the
bored.
Genius on the screen.
I never once felt like, oh, get to the point already.
Well, he's right that you feel the time passing, which you don't with Tarkovsky. Tarkovsky, you get in there and all of a sudden the movie's over and you go, was that really over 3 hours?
Yeah.
Whereas this one,
it didn't feel like was it 2 hours and 45 minutes? I did not, when it ended, I thought, I was like, oh, maybe we were at 2 hours.
I did feel the length, but it never bothered me.
It never bothered me.
Then again, I've sat through the Ring cycle. Yeah, that's 18 hours. Not in one night. That's in four parts. But yes, I've sat through Götterdämmerung at the opera. I've sat through it at the WBAI annual broadcast, being the engineer for the whole thing.
That being said, I don't think the film is for everyone. I we were saying this before, but it is a $150 million art film.
I think that's a great phrase.
They said a similar thing about the first movie. It is,
which people have to remember, was also not commercially successful.
Not commercially successful, became a cult hit.
It made its money back, but that's not what investors
want. They don't want that.
They want $150 million to be a billion.
Big blockbuster,
And actually, I'm not sure why this wasn't.
I think a couple reasons. Number one, it's a sequel to a movie that came out in 82. Okay, so.
Do you think that somebody could see this without having seen the first?
I was asked this question recently, and I'm probably not the best person to ask because I've seen the first one, said so many times that it's impossible for me to imagine what it's like. I think
as a person who's seen
probably,
it under 10 times.
You probably would want to know how the first one ended at the very least. But I think that
depending on the version.
I kind of feel like you maybe want to have seen the first.
What I would say to that?
Yeah.
I would say that you could see this without having seen the first, but you get a whole lot more out of it.
Yeah, obviously.
If you have seen the first.
Yeah.
But it could stand alone.
It could stand on its own. You might not really understand, what the Nexus replicants are and why they were. I mean, you would, but you.
They do mention it. They hiring or executing of the Nexus.
That's
6
true.
Replicants.
That's a good point. They do give you that summary, that crawl.
There
at the
is
beginning.
The exposition, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just like the crawl in the original film.
Yeah, yeah.
Very much. And then the next thing you see is the eye.
The eye, which is just like the original.
Just like the original film. But then the difference is instead of seeing this amazing cityscape that Douglas Trumbull created for
the so-called Hades landscape.
Yeah. Instead of with the fire,
the smokestacks explode, flames.
Instead, you see total sterility of solar collectors.
Yeah.
And
which are also sort of shaped like an eye.
They were
circular, and there's.
I mean, both films had geniuses in movie craft.
Yeah.
The first film, for the issues that I had with it, which are really plot issues, their problem, I see, and I still saw it seeing the final cut, that I see the first film as a series of brilliant set pieces placed together, that together you can create a narrative.
Your own narrative. Well, it's interesting you say that because I was reading a lot of, media about the original film before I saw 2049, and there was
a 4-hour documentary.
Yeah, and there was a blog post I read about someone who had seen it for the first time, last month, the original for the first time, and their opinion of it. And it was really interesting because they were seeing it through the lens of today. And that's when I realized that Blade Runner is a Rorschach, right? So
yeah.
We go into it. You know, I've seen it so many times that my mood will affect how I feel about the film. There are times when I'm not in a great mood and I watch Blade Runner, I'm like, boy, that film, oh, I don't know why I thought that was great. And then other times I go into it and I'm like, that is the best freaking thing I've, you know, I can't believe this was ever made. And not only that, but like...
There's a seawall, by the way.
There's a seawall?
Yeah.
I took the headphones off because when I hear my own voice, I get distracted. But,
yeah.
Yeah, anyway. See, I'm already distracted. I forgot what I was talking about. But, yes, it's a Rorschach test. And we go into it and we get out of it. So, like, you know, some people saw the fact that Deckard shoots a woman in the back, and that was the highlight for them. Other people said, oh, you know, this is a film about slavery and the working class, and other people saw...
Yeah, we have to mention that the woman is not a human being. The one who shoots in the back.
He shoots Zora in the back, but, I mean, I think, like, what's interesting is that, you know, the replicants come to Earth, and what do? They get jobs. I mean, you know, they're just trying to live, and then they get shot.
They're attacking the Tyrell Corporation. They're trying to get in there, and because they're trying to prolong their lives, and when they find out that this isn't possible, they even kill, you know, poor J.R. Sebastian.
There's no doubt that they are murderers.
They don't have empathy. It's simple. They don't empathize, so it's easy to murder.
But
they're rather cruel.
So, but you say that,
but I disagree
with you. Because,
I disagree with me too.
Because
Roy's reaction to Pris's death.
Roy's reaction to Pris's death. Also, the fact that Leon has family photos that he has to go back and get them. To him, these are precious memories.
Except they are implanted.
They're implanted, but he still feels this.
Yes.
The point goes along with Philip K. Dick, where. Even, you know, what Philip K. Dick's work, like, is it real even if it's just imagined? Like.
Well, yeah, that is the Dick thing. But, you see, here's the thing, is that, and you just brought it up, the movie contradicts itself at a few points, and that's one of them.
No, it doesn't contradict. It adds ambiguity, because the problem with that, I like the Marvel movies, I have fun with the superhero movies, but oftentimes there's always a very clear... This is the evil person, and this is the good person, and they toy with the, you know, oh, you know, like in the Daredevils and the Netflix, he's like, oh, you know, he has a dark side, but it's like very clear that he's like Blade Runner, and I prefer narratives where there is ambiguity. It's not to say that every single, you know, character has to have a dark side, and everyone with the dark side has to have, you know, some light in their soul or something. I mean, but it adds a level of ambiguity that forces you to think about it, and forces you to say, you know, wow, Batty's like really evil. He crushes, you know, Tyrell's head to death, and he kills Sebastian. And,
well, that's
know,
so that,
and they say
you know,
at the beginning
he doesn't just kill Tyrell. He
crushes it, and
it's,
you know,
nasty.
But at the same time, you're like, he was a total slave, and he just wanted, you know, he wanted freedom.
Yeah.
And at the end, he saves Deckard because he's just like, he wants someone to remember him.
Yeah, and that was the whole tears in the rain speech.
Yeah,
which, by the way, people say that was improvised. That Rutger Hauer came up with much of that speech.
I don't think he improvised it
completely
while they were shooting.
Hi, Shan. We were just talking about your new book, The City of Brass, from Harper Voyager, coming out later this month. Are you going to? I wrote you. Are you going to be in the show in 3 weeks? I hope, or is it 2 weeks? I hope you are. Congratulations on your book launch. Sorry, go on. For people who don't get it, you can watch this show on Facebook.
And our send reader us messages. For November 7th. And Jim will respond. I can't see what you're writing, but he can read it.
I can turn it around, but then people would see it. But they don't want to see it.
You never know.
They got to see me and only me for the last 3 years. Except when Madeline Flieger is here. Okay. I let her engineer, and she got Rick Bowes and I together.
Oh, okay.
That was great.
Yeah.
But she's busy.
Yeah, so I was saying about Batty is that Rutger Hauer was that I think when they were just doing the script reads, he added that line and then gave a little little boy smirk to the it was either Hampton Fancher or David Peebles and
my understanding is that Hampton Fancher more or less does the treatments. And then somebody else does the actual script.
Well, he did the original treatment to try to get the funding, but then they said, well, I don't know if this is quite working. Write the script. So, I mean, he ended up doing like I think dozens of drafts, and then they brought in David Peoples, and Ridley Scott had some edits there.
I think my biggest issues with the first movie are probably at David Peoples' feet. I've got to say, Michael Green.
Well, it's hard to say who wrote what because there were so many revisions. I mean, you can't specifically say, "Oh, that's people's."
Well, so many edits.
Right, but you can't say, "Oh, well, that's Scott wrote that and Fancher wrote that and Peoples wrote that."
And Rutger Hauer improv'd that.
Improv that, and well, that is well known that he improv'd that Tears and Rain.
You see, I didn't know that until recently. So. Yeah. Well known, but not to me.
Oh, actually, I forgot all about it. I'm wearing my Blade Runner shirt.
Oh, you got to show it.
Tears and Rain.
Hold on.
Does that show enough?
Oh, gorgeous.
I should take... Here, I'll take it off so I can... I'm taking off my clothes live on...
Oh, listen, when Lister comes in, everybody...
I forgot I had it.
Everybody tunes in just
my cousin bought this to me. There's Batty.
Lister,
crying.
Okay, yeah.
Tears. Anyway.
Here we go. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't see that if you're listening, but it's Batty.
You can go to Facebook even if it's after the fact.
Yeah, it's Roy Batty with his head down. It looks like a drawing over
it's,
a photograph.
It's thank God, Ryan Gosling. There was one point at the very end of the new movie where if Ryan Gosling had said 3 words...
Yeah,
I would pan the entire film, and he didn't. So thank
God.
No,
I mean
you know what the 3 words are.
Yeah, of course.
Time.
Time to die.
Yeah, that would have slaughtered the brilliance of this film.
I do feel that, for me, and this is a huge spoiler, right? So turn it off if you don't want to.
Yeah, we've warned people.
All right, so like when he's on the steps of the Stalin Institute and he's bleeding out. And then they start playing the Tears and Rain music, right?
Which is enough of the connection right there.
So, but I thought that was a little too on the nose. I thought that was like, okay, we get it, but I don't need to hear. I mean,
because
I know it, yeah.
Tuned, you're so ingrained.
Yeah, I picked it.
For me, who hadn't seen the original movie at that point for 15 years.
Okay, so you didn't.
No, it was memory.
Did you sense a change in the tone of the music when you heard that?
Yes.
You did?
Well,
okay.
No, I recognized that it was from that scene. So instead of saying those 3 words that I did not want to hear, instead it evoked the memory of what went on in the first film without destroying what was going on in this film.
Okay.
So it worked for me.
All right. I got a question for you. You've only seen it once, so you may not have picked this up. This is more of a interpolation, I guess, of what was going on. So Deckard is raising bees, right? He's an apiary.
Yes.
Okay. Which was
just like the roof of this building.
Okay. Which was sort of
as I say, putting the bee back into WBAI.
Yeah. Or bees.
New York.
So, which I thought
that would be BS, and BAI has always said BS.
Which I thought was kind of astounding that they had this, like, literally, like, hive of life, like this just sort of thriving colony.
Which is the opposite of the first film and the book, in which animals are hardly alive.
But I think in this world the same thing is true, like, because, like, let me get to this.
Okay.
One of the prostitutes that approach Kay says, "I've never seen a real tree."
That's right.
So there are no trees left in the world, or at least they're so rare that people don't even. And then, like, when Kay goes to that,
she never saw Silent Running.
That guy in the street, and he's like, "This is real wood. You're rich." And so it's like, this is a world where wood is ridiculously rare, and trees are dead, and yet there are live bees.
Earth has been decimated. Wait.
Oh, yes. So, two things. One, this is an amazing symbol of life, which was possibly representative of the fact that not everything is bleak, that there may be some hope there. Mm-hmm. Number two, at the very beginning of the movie, when Kay turns around and, like, he goes back into his spinner and he's about to fly away, and then he looks over at the tree, and do you remember what he sees at the base of the tree?
Oh, aside from the date and the number,
there was a little yellow flower.
That's right.
A buttercup. Now, think about this for a second. I'll let you connect the dots. What do bees need?
Flowers.
Deckard was farming bees. That was Rachel's grave.
Yeah.
It's possible that Deckard was visiting her grave.
It's likely.
And put a flower, which is probably in this world.
I actually recognize that as Rachel's grave later.
In this world, which is probably, like, more precious than gold, more valuable than diamonds, that he would take a flower and put it on her grave.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that was, like, and that was just, like, a little tiny thing that you don't, if you're not paying attention.
The movie is filled.
The movie is filled with stuff like that. And
almost every scene.
Almost every scene. And, you know, the second time through, I picked up a lot more of that type of stuff because I was looking for it. Because the first time through, I'm just sort of absorbing it. And the second time through, I'm looking for stuff.
Maybe I'll go tomorrow. I mean, the thing is that I'm afraid, maybe I'm wrong, and I hope I'm wrong, but I want to forewarn listeners. A, this movie needs to be seen on a big screen.
It does.
Not only for its incredible cinematography and art design, but also for the detail. You're not going to see that on your 40-inch equivalent of a Trinitron or something like that.
Yeah.
It's just wrong. Like, seeing 2001 A Space Odyssey is on a small screen is wrong. Like, you know, for those people who are old enough to remember the first time that an Imperial cruiser went over their head in the movie called Star Wars.
Yeah.
There is no movie called A New Hope. It was called Star Wars.
Star Wars, yeah.
That was a revision when they added episode 4. The first time that went over your head, if you weren't in a theater with the right THX sound system and the big bleeping screen, you were missing an experience. So the first time you saw Star Wars and you saw it as A New Hope on your nice television at home, guess what? You missed so much of the experience.
But it's important to point out that Blade Runner 2049 is not an action film. Well, there are action scenes, and there are really intense action scenes, but
near the end, bulk, I didn't breathe.
The bulk of the film is much more, like, visual and cerebral.
Just like Arrival.
Again. Yeah, yeah.
There's only one thing that even it's not an action scene in Arrival. There is an incident in Arrival that might be interpreted as a violent incident. But outside of that, there is no action in Arrival whatsoever. It's about the scripting. It's about the premise, the concept. It's about the thinking. And this is another film, folks, where it's about the thinking. If and when I go again, I know which theater I will go to.
The IMAX?
No. No, the same one where I saw it the first time.
Oh, okay.
Where they have lights underneath the tables. You sit in front of a table.
Yeah, yeah.
And those...
The Alamo Draft House.
Yeah. Which is 5 blocks from where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a light down on the table so you can read your menu and order food.
Right.
But I could write notes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't need my phone, which will obviously annoy other people.
Right.
I could take, instead of a PDA,
mm-hmm.
a personal digital assistant, I would have a PAD on which to write.
Right.
And I have every intention of making notes about this film. It is worth it.
All right, I have a couple things that you should look for. Can I tell you? Or
please.
So... You know how when he goes for his baseline...
How many times have you seen him?
Twice.
Twice, okay. There's still stuff.
There's still stuff.
Discover.
Well, you probably already recognize this, but he goes for the baseline test.
Yeah, it took me a little while after I'd seen the film to figure out what was going on there, but yeah.
Well, it was sort of like the reverse Voight Kampff, right?
Exactly.
They were making sure that they weren't having emotions or strong emotions.
In the scroll, at the beginning of the movie, this is a spoiler-filled discussion, folks. They explained that, yes, production was stopped from the Tyrell Corporation after the Nexus 6.
Right.
But now the Wallace Corporation is up to, is it the 8, the Model 8?
I think K is 9.
I think K is 9.
9, because Sapper is 8. Sapper is 8, and then he says... You know, and then Kay says, "Oh, you're an older model."
Right. So, but the point is that they have learned how to behave, and the whole point of the baseline is to make sure that you are operating within
your parameters.
Within your parameters, as Data would say.
Yeah.
And they actually use that line in the movie.
Well, do you know the book that the quotes, "The Cells Interlinked," is actually from Pale Fire by Nabokov, and that's the book that he has in his apartment.
It's no small coincidence.
Well, I haven't read Pale Fire, but I've read about it a lot recently.
Yeah, and I know something about Nabokov.
And it has...
Nabokov? Yes. He would say, according to the mm-hmm. great Simon Lokley of WBAI,
mm-hmm.
Nabokov. It rhymes Nabokov. With knockoff.
Uh-huh.
So, that's an easy mnemonic.
Yeah. And then also Joseph K, because Joseph K was the in Kafka's trial. Yeah,
very much so. Yeah, but, that there's no subtlety there.
Right.
That he is called K. It's not just his serial number. It is representative of, again, he's still a subject of a... totalitarian system.
Yeah.
It doesn't look as totalitarian as the first film, but it is in so many more subtler ways. And the other movie that this invokes in many ways, one of my favorite films of the last 10 years, is Her.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's that scene where they, you know...
Which
was very much a copy of Her, and we're talking
an
about
improvement
the,
in a way. Well, in Her, there is a sex surrogate an AI.
Right. In this one, it's the same thing, except the AI is holographic, so
one can inhabit.
And I thought that was
the
an astounding scene, and then that line that. What's her name? Mackenzie says,
"Yeah, Mackenzie.
I've been in you. There's not much there."
Yes.
And I was like, "Whoa, that's crazy." But what I was going to say is,
and that, by the way, is supposed to be echoing something from Nabokov as well.
Yeah, but Joy says
J-O-Y. Yes.
J-O-Y. K's, you know,
companion.
Companion.
Holographic.
Holographic.
Companion.
Companion says made she hates Pale Fire.
Yeah.
She doesn't like it.
No.
But she's programmed everything you want to see, everything you want to hear. Right? That's his favorite book.
To tell people that's her slogan. When you buy a Joy unit, that's the ad, which you don't really get to see until the end. Everything you want to see, everything you want to hear.
Right, which is interesting because she says, I hate this book.
She is fascinating. There is
and he loves it. So it's like you would think that if that was his favorite book, she'd be like, oh, I love it too. But she says, I hate it.
But she's also programmed.
Right.
And that is, for me, one of the biggest blows in the movie is in, like, a penultimate scene, if not the final scene of the film.
When she calls him Joe, when the hologram.
Yeah.
Hey, little Joe.
When she called him Joe, the fact that she calls him Joe. This is, okay, let's explain. She gives him a name, and all of a sudden he's like, I'm not just a replicant anymore.
You're a real boy.
I have an identity.
Yeah.
I'm a boy. I'm Pinocchio. Yeah. I have really come to life here.
Right.
And he lives for that, and he dwells for that. And then later on, near the end of the film, and everybody has seen this image of this holographic, gorgeous figure of a woman who is pointing at the tiny little Ryan Gosling as he's on a walkway, and the ad that she bespeaks that's telling you to buy a Joy, which is very much like the beginning again of her before he buys the AI, the OS, and installs it in his ear. She said, I don't remember the exact line, but she basically says, this is something you want, don't you, Joe? And the whole point...
He said, like, you're a good little Joe, I think, something like that.
Or something like that.
Yeah,
I don't. But the point that she uses that name,
right.
That she uses the name that was so precious to him, and guess what? It was just programming that she... didn't have the depth. She didn't really
But did she, though? Because I think...
Well, there's an ambiguity.
I think the director wanted you to...
I think he wanted you to wonder.
Wanted you to wonder. And I'll give you a couple places where I...
I chose my answer.
I think that she is sentient. And I'll tell you a couple reasons. Hmm. First, they have... the ability to scan memories and record memories. And so I think it would be very easy for something with that technology to create an AI that is human-like.
Particularly for replicants. Can they, so they're not just scanning a memory of a person.
Right, but they could have a very clear picture. I mean, literally, Kay just sits in front of the machine and she's like, oh, I'm looking at your memory, and there's that thing behind his head.
That's right.
So, I mean, if they have technology to that, I'm sure they can... map what someone's like brain struck, but anyway, I mean, I'm not even talking about like the technology, but so there's the scene, right, where Joy says to him, let's go for a ride, let's go see if you're a real boy, and then they leave, they go in his spinner, and it's one of the most beautiful shots of, I mean, you talk about something that you want to see in the theater.
In 3 hours of beautiful shots.
When they leave the city and they're flying over the seawall and they look up and there's some kind of ship or something hovering there and it looks like a skyscraper, but it's like a ship or something. And he's driving the car, right? So he's driving the flying car and he's looking and he's, he's flown over this how many hundreds of times. It's every day for him.
Yeah.
She's looking up in wonder.
Hmm.
He's not even looking at her. So if she's
She could be a learning AI.
Yeah, but if you look at her eyes, she's looking just up in astonishment.
Mm.
She's like...
just like Sam in Her.
Yeah. And so it's like there's no reason in her programming for her. Because also, like, she doesn't actually really need to technically, like, see, right? I mean, she's like a basically... I don't know how she even, like, scans the world. It's like that thing in his pocket that looks sort of like the Apple remote.
Not a coincidence.
No. But she's looking up in wonder, and he's not looking at her. There, so if she is there just to be an object for him, why look up and wonder at this thing that doesn't involve him that he's seen every day?
It's the first time that she's mobile, you know, before.
Yeah.
She's sedentary. She's stuck in his apartment and has a field, sort of like a router, a modem router,
yeah,
Wi-Fi router would have today. But he's bought a rather expensive thing that basically allows for mobile Wi-Fi.
It's basically like, you know, the iPhone 70, right? So it's like you know instead of this expensive thing that you have to install in your home on your ceiling, you know, you can now carry it in your pocket. And
there are things like, there's a device called a Freedom Pop. It's a put it in your pocket Wi-Fi device.
Yeah.
They've been around for a while. But here's another interesting thing about the use of the Nabokov book. In the movie Her, one of the things that I think people missed altogether, that I think is a very, very important facet of Her, that just
her and her?
Most people buy, Her and Her, is when, is it Sam?
Yeah.
When the Scarlett Johansson voice.
Yeah.
When Joaquin Phoenix character realizes that, you know, she, her attention is not on him alone,
but
since it's so fast.
Yeah.
And she wants to introduce him to somebody.
It's Alan Watts.
Okay, thank you.
Well, not that, Alan Watts,
yeah,
but a
Alan
creation.
Alan Watts 2.0.
Right, you know.
And, well, okay, you see, you caught it. I wonder how many listeners.
Well, he says I'm Alan Watts.
Yes, he does. But what significance does that have to the majority of people watching that movie? To me, it was jaw-dropping because I engineered Alan Watts once. He's from Pacifica Radio, gang, mostly from our West Coast station.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave. And by the way, if you subscribe to WBAI at the right rate, look under the premiums, you can get something like 60 hours of Alan Watts lectures. And they're worth it, believe me.
Yeah.
It's not just mumbo jumbo. It's fascinating philosophy. Very much about.
I've read a few of his books. It's very interesting.
He's a fascinating person. He really was. And many of his questions were not coincidentally, I think, many of the questions that Philip K. Dick asked as well, and that Ridley Scott asked, and that Villeneuve asked. And of course, Spike Jonze, the writer and director of Her. The point that in 30 seconds we are exposed to Alan Watts, of all the people and all the gin joints that they choose to bring out in the movie Her, it's Alan Watts, who is not a famous, well-known person. What am I playing?
Maybe among certain groups.
I think I'm playing something out of the Las Vegas scene. I'm going to switch that.
Okay.
It's got lyrics. I didn't.
Yeah, I took the headphones off, so I don't even hear.
Yeah, no need. I'm going to be. I have now switched it. I just like the ambiance.
Yeah.
Oops. No, not the howl. Thank you. I played my intro again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the invocation of Alan Watts in Her.
Yeah.
Is in some ways analogous not to the invocation of Nabokov in Blade Runner 2049.
And Kafka.
Uh-huh. Well, but the thing is that they never say, okay,
also,
that's like from
also
Kafka.
Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But the thing is that those are noticeable things within the texture and story of the movie.
Yeah.
What both Spike Jonze in Her and Villeneuve and Michael Green, the scriptwriter, along with Hampton Fancher, did in 2049 is they named the writer. They showed you the cover of the book.
Yeah.
And that's not just a, oh, here's something, you know, like here's a bit of Metropolis, here's a bit of this, here's a bit of that. This was an in-your-face showing of here's a writer, here's a philosophy that you should be aware of, that is important to the telling of this story.
Yeah.
And I think knowing more about Pale Fire, at the very least, folks, you go to Wikipedia and you read up on it so that you can get the summary of how it fits into this movie. He wants you. He's telling you, know this book.
Yeah. I don't think you need to necessarily be overly familiar or even familiar at all with the book.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
They're sort of saying, you know, if you want to dive deeper into this sort of philosophy and metafiction.
Watching us online is saying it's not a throwaway. It's something the filmmaker considers the viewer needs to know about. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
He wants you to know that. I totally agree with her.
Yeah.
It's a nice thing, but
yeah.
I think that sentience, the question of the first movie is all about the sentience of the Nexus 6.
Right.
I think that the question of the sentience of joy is an important facet here.
Well, what I found interesting with 2049 was that in some ways joy is the most human.
Hey, Lester.
Hey, man. Is the most human of all the characters in the film, right? So she is the one that has hope.
Most grounded.
Hope, and she's also smiles more than anyone. I mean, I think
Robin Wright
may smile once or twice.
Boss, yeah.
But
she smiles sardonically.
There's a bitterness to the smile, but like joy, there's a genuineness, and you can say, well, it might be programmed. But I thought that was fascinating that the most human element of the film came from, you know, not, you know, probably the most non-human, right? Because you have these genetically engineered replicants, which are human-like, but they're not human.
Nor are they very, very important people. They're not robots.
They're not robots. I was on another podcast, and someone kept calling them robots, and I was like, they're not robots.
They're not robots. There's no metal in them.
Right.
They're
flesh and blood. They're just, you could think of them, it's easier to think of them as, like, clones that are born, you know, as adults.
They're engineered humans.
So like,
by the way, they never answer the question, how long is Kay's lifespan? How long is the lifespan of these Nexus models?
I don't know if that's relevant. I mean,
maybe not. It's
it's longer.
The first movie.
Well,
is
actually,
all about
actually,
that.
You know, they sort of do in the fact that Sapper Morton, David Bautista, right?
Ages,
right? Because there's that scene where Kay is walking down the hallway in the Wallace Corporation, and you see a Nexus 8 sample, I guess, and you see Sapper's model. He's, like, floating there. And it's young and, you know, smooth skin, and then you see, like, the real Sapper who wears glasses and has gray hair. Mm-hmm. And is older and has wrinkles. So clearly they've been living there, and this is 30 years later, and he was there for the birth of the child, so he's lived at least 30 years after, you know. So if he's a Nexus 8 with no termination date, Sapper, then Kay, if Kay's a more recent model, Nexus 9, one would assume that he also
doesn't have...
You know, yeah, I don't think they would necessarily have an engineered termination date. They did have an engineered obedience function, if you want to call it that. Whereas there's that really great, almost throwaway line where Robin writes, like, what if I finish that bottle? What happens? And she's basically hitting on him.
Yeah.
And she could easily, like, she said, what if I said that was an order, you know?
Yeah.
And basically testing out his free will. You know, would you do this if I didn't order you to? And I thought, wow, that's really fascinating. Like,
yeah, and it brings up the whole question of sex bots.
Right. I mean, you know, there is, some people brought up the issue of the fact that, you know,
which
Joy is basically, you know, like a sex bot, but, you know.
Except she has no body.
She has no body. But Robin Wright, you know, almost objectified Kay, but then didn't, because, like, she could clearly have ordered him to do it, and she stopped, because she's, you know, she's not a monster. You know, she's human. I mean, she's
We also don't know what rules there are about that.
No.
We're never told. There could be rules. Just
there are, you know, if you would assume that it's probably in any organization, you're not supposed to fraternize with, you know, people that are under your command. I imagine they would probably have something like that in the LAPD.
Yeah. One would hope.
But, you know, it's, you know, stuff happens.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it happened quite a lot in that world.
Hello, listeners.
Oh, thank you, man.
Let's get you on camera there. Hello.
Cheers. All right.
And, the Joy fascinated me. She really did. I think that she was, I think there is a lot to be thought of about her. Oh, but let's talk about two characters we haven't even mentioned yet.
Yeah.
And one of them, I feel, I would be just as happy if he weren't in the movie. And that's the Jared Leto character.
I know you said that.
He is not the big bad. Love, the woman.
Yeah.
She is the big bad. She is the one who can and just about does undo everything that they are after. What Jared Leto represents is he is the stand-in for Tyrell.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel, and he is demonstrably cruel.
Yeah.
He's cruel. He has a purpose for destroying. He
wants to basically save humanity. There's this idea in the film, and it's, if you have you seen the, there's three short films.
No, I have heard this. Yeah, I want to see them.
And basically,
so. And I know
they go into this
one
a little
of stars Jared Leto.
Yeah, and they go into a little bit more that basically, the colonies are struggling. That they are surviving, like, food wise and stuff, but they're not. There's not enough people. There's not enough work. There's not enough labor.
Now we're getting into Philip K. Dick territory.
Right, and so
Villeneuve is closer to Dick than Scott.
You know, Wallace. You know, Leander Wallace is basically saying, you know, we need my replicants to reach the stars. And so it's like, in his mind, he feels like he's saving humanity, but you realize, like, to do this, they have to abandon their humanity. You know what I mean?
It's,
so I mean, I hear you that you didn't need him, but I mean,
yeah, we're hoping that everybody listening at this point, again, this is a spoiler filled version.
Yeah.
But what he does is he brings one of the experimental models, possibly a Nexus 10, or X, God help us, iPhone joke there, from its sort of fetal womb, its womb-like thing, brings it into life. It goes through the horror and terror of birth,
being alive, yeah.
And then when he realizes that it's not capable of bearing children, he takes a knife and he cuts her womb open. until she lies there dying horribly.
It was a horrible scene, and
a scene of horror. I saw it as a horrible scene.
It was disturbing in many ways.
Mm.
And you know, if you look
I thought it was superfluous, or there's a point that the writer and director is making that eludes me.
I mean, I don't think we needed that to see that Wallace was cruel.
We agree.
I think we got that, and that scene may have been a little too much, but I will say that the horror that unnamed replicant experienced was visceral. I felt it. There was nothing about that scene that was enjoyable to watch, and yet I felt that it was powerful when it was over, like emotionally, like a gut punch.
Well, maybe the gut punch when Pris dies in the first film.
Yeah,
she dies a horrible, horrible.
Yeah,
death.
Like the way she's screaming. But I also
and the flapping,
the flapping and screaming. Oh. But I also want to say, like, Love. You know, Wallace's
Love, L-U-V, is
L-U-V, her, his henchwoman, is basically
great character.
She cries. Like,
that's
like
right.
She cries, and if you look, if you watch, anytime she kills, she cries.
That's right.
So there's this sense.
So is
that
programming, and there's somebody behind her that has empathy.
I think that's what it is that there's empathy behind, you know, they're programmed to obey, but they are not robots.
She kills because she must.
She's crying.
But that doesn't mean that within
she's
she
crying for the replicant that died. So we see that she has empathy. And then when she kills Robin Wright, she cries again.
You're right.
That's
really interesting. I think I've learned.
And she also kisses. Kisses, you know, whoever she kills before she kills him, which is something that Wallace does.
Yeah.
So she was like trying to imitate him. She, you know, there's that line that Kay says. He's like, "Oh, he liked you so much, he gave you a name."
Right.
And that comes into play later when, you know.
Also, by the way, I wonder. Love, is the letter after K.
I don't know. I mean,
I
don't know.
I might be reading too much into
yeah.
it.
He loved like you so
HAL
much. He gave you a
computer
name.
Is like one letter ahead of IBM.
Here's something that I'm pretty sure was intentional. The film has a large number of like wall metaphors, and you know.
Yeah.
Actual walls, right? So you have the seawall. You have the walls of the city, like that, you know, the walls of, you know, Kay's room, the walls of the police station. You have Leander Wallace, mm-hmm. right? Wallace.
Oh, okay.
Right?
I thought of that.
Okay, but here, stay with me on this.
Yeah.
When Kay goes to get the records, he's basically walking through a room of walls. Like there's just wall of wall.
Yeah, yeah.
In San Diego, the dumps, the demolishers are constantly tearing down walls.
I call them the Wally scenes, yes.
Yeah.
Wall-E.
Then there's the scene in Las Vegas when Wallace's people are coming in the spinners, Deckard runs downstairs, locks the door, and Kay breaks through the wall.
Right.
So there's all these
wall metaphors.
Wall metaphors, and there's
both in pun and in
and then at the
visual.
End, the final battle's on the seawall.
Yeah.
On the other side, outside the wall, and if you, the when the scene that Joy says to Kay. You know, you should find out if you're a real boy. And he says, "Do you want to go for a ride?" The next shot, the very next shot, if my memory serves me, I've only seen it twice, is a picture of the seawall and the gates opening and the water coming out. The wall is opening. Yeah. And that's like, if you, the music at that point is like the
actually,
orchestra, like the
we're
keyboard.
We're actually listening to it right now.
We are?
Yeah, we are.
The synth. Yeah.
We're not quite.
Yeah, yeah. It's not. I don't know if it's exactly
okay,
that moment.
You know what?
But you don't have to.
I'm going
to
skip ahead. There we are.
All right, hang on. Put it. I'll put the headset on so I can hear. I think that I'd have to listen to it carefully.
This is the cut called Seawall. We're 2 minutes. For, yeah, this is.
Yeah, yeah. So okay, yeah. So it's like that moment, where basically the waters are opening. So like the idea is the walls are coming down. And then the final, you know, the nail in the coffin, so to speak, is when Robin Wright says to Kay, there's a wall that separates kind.
Ooh.
So like, this was intentional. Neander Wallace, you know, wall separates kind, the seawall.
One thing I've learned about yeah. Villeneuve, having yeah. watched Arrival a few times, and I will in the future, will have seen this a few times.
Yeah.
Is there is nothing is accidental. Everything is symbolic. Everything has a purpose of one kind or another in his films. And he is a leaping genius. He is. I think the best thing to an auteur director, at least a North American auteur. Director.
He's from Montreal, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. I heard that he's doing Dune,
a remake
of Dune. That's going to be amazing.
Well, I hope that. I mean, David Lynch's original Dune.
I love
going
that.
To be seven. Oh, you and me.
You like it? I know people hate it, but I.
No. Sorry, yeah. I like it a lot. There are some problems.
There are parts that are slow, but I.
And I think that he goes a little far with the Baron Harkonnen. But I also know why he went that way with the Baron.
Yeah.
See, in the book, the reason the Baron is evil, what mm-hmm. tells us he is evil, is the fact that he lusts after Fade Rautha, played by Sting.
Sting, yeah.
In the movie. That's it. It's, I think, a certain amount of homophobia, perhaps, on Frank Herbert's part. He wouldn't be the first homophobic science fiction writer out there, nor the last. And I don't think Lynch could deal with that idea, so he went over the top in a different manner so that he could prove that the Baron is evil. Because if you take a look at what the Baron does in the book versus what Duke Leto does, one isn't worse than the other. They're
right.
simply political rivals.
Right.
But the Baron has to be evil. So in one book, he lusts after his nephew. And in the movie, he sucks the blood of harmless little thingies.
Yeah.
Outside of that, I was working at a talent agency at the time that Dune was being cast. And so I got to see the casting call, what they call the breakdown sheet.
Yeah.
It was for a 7-hour movie.
Yeah. Have you seen the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune?
Not yet.
Oh, you need to.
I know I need to.
You need to drop whatever you're doing. Pause the radio show.
Jodorowsky was Adler's favorite directors.
It is astounding how... I wish that film had been made. There was no way it could have been made because it was just too expensive, but...
And that was the same with Lynch's film.
Yeah.
Especially with the De Laurentiis...
But a lot of that film. A lot of that concept art made its way into other films.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much
so. I think Star Wars and I don't know if it made it into Blade Runner, but...
Possibly.
Alien. Alien and possibly Aliens and...
And yeah. to Ron Cobb's work, which very much informed, shall we say, H.R. Geiger's
right.
work.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of those alien images were, well, visible in other people's work before Geiger did them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Geiger perfected it.
Yeah.
We are just about out of time.
Oh, man.
If you can believe it. Yeah, I would love 3 hours.
I know.
But we have 3 minutes.
Oh, boy.
And, I think what we need to tell people is, now, people have heard me. I have an old joke. And people say, how do you get listener phone calls at blah, blah, blah in the morning? And I would say, oh, it's very simple. I go on the air and I'd say, Blade Runner sucks. Call area code, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. And all the phones would light up. And I would take on all comers. I can't. Okay, number one, I can't do it anymore. And I'm talking about Blade Runner 2019. Especially after having watched the final cut. I see things, not to quote Sondheim, I see things now that I've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hating the movie less and less, and moving from hating it to really admiring it a great deal, but still finding flaws. And those flaws...
You look deeply enough in any film, you're going to find flaws.
Absolutely, but I mean major plot flaws and things like that. I could MST3K that movie like nobody else, and you would be horrified, especially you. But all that aside, this film,
yeah,
Blade Runner 2049, is just a brilliant work of genius. I think it is the closest thing that we have seen or will see to a Kubrick-like auteur in the cinema for a time to come, and I can't wait to see the stuff that he does in the future. And Michael Green, the scriptwriter, have you looked at what else he's written in the last couple of years? Logan?
Right.
Just to name one. I mean, you take a look at his list, and you're going, whoa, this guy is prolific and good.
Yeah, yeah.
So these are people to watch, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew Kressel is somebody to watch. You can do so this Saturday at QED in Astoria. Look it up on Facebook, and you will know more. Shan Chakraborty, who is joining us on Facebook, watching vicariously, along with Chris Dykeman, is somebody to watch. Come to 388 Atlantic Avenue this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. Admission is free, but we'll look at you with puppy eyes for a donation. And then that's also available on live stream, so you can watch it. And I'll announce more about the next KGB as that approacheth. But meet Matt Kressel along with Sam J. Miller and Austin...
Grossman,
thank you, and some other very fine people curated by William Shun, who also does a piece every QED. It's a wonderful venue. It's a wonderful series. And I really advise people to go. There you go, Bill. Okay, so, Matt, thank you so much. Next time you're here again as a writer.
Okay. Well, maybe I can read something next time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we only had the 2 hours.
Yeah.
But I would love to hear more of your fiction. You've got a lot of short fiction coming out.
Yeah.
Including in Nightmare Magazine next month.
Mm-hmm.
And Queen of Shards is still in print.
King of Shards. King of Shards, you can still get the ebook.
Oh, get the ebook.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
And I think that more or less sums it up. People can reach me on Facebook as Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D. You can write me Jim@ourwolf.com. And, well, it's ubiquitous. It's ubic, as Philip K. Dick would say. So thank you so much. This was tip of the iceberg.
Cheers. Thank you.
Yeah. And no, Dan, the movie doesn't run too long. It runs about an hour short. if anything, I would have loved a two-part. And by the way, it is set up for a sequel. It's subtle.
Yeah.
It's subtle.
I don't know. I don't know if I want to see a sequel. I think I would like to leave it.
I mean, because
it'd be hard to
Yeah, but you know,
do that again.
They're going to do it, and they're not going to do it as well.
Exactly.
It's like like 2010 Odyssey 2.
Yeah.
It's not a bad movie, but it ain't Kubrick.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it was watered down. It was Arthur C. Clarke without Kubrick, and that just didn't cut it.
Right.
Although I love John Lithgow in it. And
yes, he was great.
Oh, he was wonderful. And Bob Balaban and Helen Mirren finally playing
it's
a
Russian. Shrinking!
Yeah. Yeah, no, it has its moments.
Yes.
So, everybody, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I would like to thank the program director for not preempting us this morning, because this is a fundraising morning. And we took time out from that. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers, starring Lister, Red Dwarf, you know the TV series, right? Coming your way in but a few moments. People, be good to each other. This has been a nasty week in New York. And all over the world, you must be good. Treat people as you would treat yourself. Have a good morning, and thanks for listening. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Yo, that's that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn, like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the figs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
The revolutionary step. hard work. Now if you wanna sweat,
yeah,
let's feel a bit you get.
And jump for the better, faster and higher. Let the music get to your bones. Move on the tip of your toes. Like a lion in the jungle. Move smoother and don't you stumble.
The revolutionary step.
I dance from reggae.
Do the revolutionary step.
I dance, you will never forget.
Do the revolutionary step.
Step forward, brothers and sisters, step forward.
You mean no LSD?
No.
Not any cocaine?
No. Want to do it again and again. To you, it may look hard to do, but believe I, it isn't so. Do it once and twice, then your love bound to grow.
Turn the lights.